Good morning. Thank you all for coming bright and early on a rainy day in Milwaukee. So I'm beginning to think about how we get to a sort of newer approaches in modeling, incorporating more from molecular biology. So I'll take you to through a little bit of thinking I have about phasic development in sorghum and working from old data sets. And I see I'd better be careful because Joe Ritchie is here, and I'm sure he'll have some hard questions for me. So phenology is clearly important. If you don't get your phenology right, you won't get your yield data right. So the Dalton papers from Crop Science in 1967 saying that if you're doing anything with sorghum and you don't consider the time of flowering, the relation between time of flowering and yield, you're not going to be able to understand what's going on. And with Mike Ottman in Arizona, two locations, similar looking trends. And so we can, our current simulation models, like the cropping system model in DSAT, which is the sorghum, is now sort of a hybrid of phenology between the crop grow model and the series model. You can predict Day's strand thesis quite well, so simulated versus measured with an R-squared of 0.96, a root mean square error of about 4 days. But is 4 days good enough? Maybe good, but not good enough. If you go back to the Dalton graph, that was a response of about 220 kilos per day of yield. So if you've got a 4 days error, you're getting up close to a 1 ton error in yield just because your phenology's not quite right. So that's it's a concern. I think that anything we can do to get the 4 day error down a little bit will help us in the accuracy of our yield prediction. And of course, traditionally in phenology, we've used a phasic approach, recognizing phases of germination to emergence, a pre-inductive or photoperiod insensitive phase, then a period here during panicle initiation that is photoperiod sensitive. And then further phases on down to anthesis, and then also grain filling. So as I said, I'm beginning to think how I think we pushed the phasic approach, and it's worked remarkably well. But it's a question of how to go further. And so one group that's looking at can we learn something from molecular biology is Hamish Brown and Pete Jameson, Ian Brooking, and colleagues started to look at the molecular biology evidence in wheat and applying it then to a wheat or was a phenology model. So this was really, I think, to me, is a landmark paper. It's the first time I've seen the crop modeler say, let's really try and synthesize everything that's out there in molecular biology. So my question, part of my question today is, where are we going with sorghum? And there is getting to be a large body of knowledge about the molecular control of flowering. They built, a lot of this has come off of work and pioneered by Quinby and colleagues in Texas. And Quinby developed a series of inbred lines that varied a known genetic loci for affecting phenology. And then the molecular biologists are now dissecting. And so, for example, MA3, I keep losing, oh, there it goes. MA3 and MA5, both basically, if you have the deleterious mutation, you don't produce phytochrome, and phytochrome, of course, is a basic pigment involved in the clocking system for photoperiod. So either of these loci will affect your photoperiod sensitivity. And I should say, so the arrows mean it's a stimulatory effect. The little inverted T's are an inhibitory effect. And so we are getting to the point where we can start looking at these molecular systems and think about applying them to models. But if you look at this sort of diagram, there's no notion of phases there. It's just the system is running and you get a floral transition at the end. So again, I want to go back and think about how we can advance the way we model a phenology of sorghum or other crops. And of course, first place is to take a look at information in the literature, so reinterpreting it based on molecular evidence. And so the two examples I'll look at today concern phase durations, and the first is work of based on work of Gopalalagarswamy when he was with ICRISAP, measuring the relative lengths of phases, and then also some work by Morgan and Quinby on morphological stages as indicators. So the underlying question for me, or one way of looking at it, is how many clocks are we talking about? You know, in our typical model, each phase can be thought of as having a clock, and we're integrating over time. You know, we finish one clock, and we start another, and we have sort of discrete endpoints. And so from a molecular biology standpoint, for example, that would say that, into emergence, and we have one set of molecular processes, then at emergence, we have a whole another set, but there'd be no photoperiod system operating. Then when we go into our photoperiod-sensitive phase, we'd have some upregulation of all the photoperiod, the processes involved in photoperiod, and then at panicle initiation, those would shut down, and a whole set of other molecular processes would take place. And that's basically a complex hypothesis that we should be able to dissect. And so, again, I'll take a look at a little bit of empirical data, not molecular data. And again, just to reinforce what I'm talking about, see, in our traditional phasic development, you might say that the photoperiod systems, you know, at zero, it's not operating. Suddenly at the onset of the photoperiod induction phase, this gene system gets turned on, it cruises along, and then we'll get, oops, and now I got to go. The alternative hypothesis, maybe there really aren't discrete phases. It just looks like a discrete phase, that we have something, you know, the photoperiod system may start at sowing or emergence, but it just slowly ramps up, and we're interpreting this as a discrete phase, but possibly it isn't. And obviously the top model then would correspond to a single clock sort of model for time up to enthesis, and then the square wave would be for a multi-clock system. So again, how many clocks? So if there was a single clock, and one thing that I would expect is that under, say, optimal conditions, so where we're not getting effects of temperature, we're not having effects of photoperiod, the relative length or the apparent relative length of the durations of individual phases would be highly correlated, because really you just have one clock and it's going fast. You know, if the faster clock would give you relatively short phases, the slow clock would give you relatively long phases. So I'll just look at some data and see. And so Mitchin Alagarswamy did this nice study, 10 cultivars varying in phenology, did 2 years, and he used a classic switching experiment where you grow plants in pots under one photoperiod, and you switch them over daily or every couple of days. And I guess the first year they did daily switches. And so what you get is this sort of thing where if it's under short days and then you switch it to long days, the flowering behavior changes. So this would be roughly equivalent to the end of your juvenile phase, and then the same at the longer ones. And if you fit Ellis outlines a method for estimating the exact lengths of the juvenile phase, a photoperiod phase, and then the time to panicle, or from panicle initiation to flowering. So what I've done is to look at this question of whether if we dissect the phases, so we take their estimate of pre-inductive phase, so to the end of the juvenile phase, versus the photoperiod phase, over this range of 10 genotypes, there is some sign of a correlation. It's not as strong as I would have liked. I mean, I think one thing to keep in mind is we're dealing with very short phase lengths, so an error of one day is going to have a big effect on the correlation. So I would say this is suggestive, but certainly not proof of correlation. The same paper also had estimates from time of panicle initiation to enthesis, and here in this graph, it looks very good. It's a correlation from time to panicle initiation versus time to flowering. And there you're really, you're sort of, it's cheating a little bit on the correlation because you're doing anthesis is floral initiation plus floral development period. So you're really correlating your panicle initiation time plus floral development time versus panicle initiation. So I regraphed this to look at the time from emergence to panicle initiation and from panicle initiation to flowering. And I just looked at the 10-hour and the 12.8-hour photoperiod treatment, so we're not getting confounding with photoperiod. And you do see a pretty strong association between the lengths of the phases, which I think supports this notion of just one big clock that either goes slow and gives you long durations or goes fast and gives you short durations. So I'd say the single main clock argument's credible. The low to medium R-squared values for the initial phases might be from artifacts of the switching experiments. That's still a really unnatural sort of system. You're taking the plant from one photoperiod and suddenly putting it into a different photoperiod. Just having resolution to calendar days also keeps us from maybe getting as accurate a definition of the phases as we might like. And also it's a question about use of morphological stages. And that's the next question I want to... Oh, and I did want to mention on calendar days, I probably should have re-expressed these as thermal time, but the mean temperature at this location was approximately 23 degrees each year without too much variation. There is some variability in day-night temperatures, which might be a concern, but I think as a first approximation, calendar days are fine for these analyses. Okay, so morphological stages. So basically, you know, our long-standing assumption is you look at changes in the shoot apical meristem, and unfortunately, I couldn't find a really good, clear image of this. But you start out with a vegetative apex, and then at some point you start to get panicle primordia coming off, and the apex gets bigger, and that's what we use to judge the floral transition. But that's a morphological indicator, and that's not necessarily what's going on with the biochemistry. So I guess, you know, one question would be is to test that, can we alter the morphological development without affecting flowering? And the answer apparently is yes. Morgan and Quinby did an experiment with gibberellic acid. You have to think this is back in 1987 when people were really excited about the potential of using growth regulators to change sort of the physiology of the crop. So they applied gibberellic acid 18, 25, and 30 days. And these are field-grown plants in Texas, you know, well-watered, fertilized, to avoid other things. But so look what happens. So these are the GA, or here's the GA treatment and the control. And you're getting like a 20-day effect by applying GA on the floral initiation and when they detect panicle initiation. But look at the flowering data. You get a 20-day change in panicle initiation, and there's no change in flowering. So that suggests that the morphological development is to a large extent uncoupled from the molecular biology. And so from the molecular biology, you know, perspective, you know, we know now that there's a florigen that's being generated and it's translocated through the phloem to the shoot apex. And that's really, you know, what's going on in terms of, you know, genes being turned on and off. That's really what matters. And what we see is the panicle initiation. Yes, obviously you're not going to get flowering if you don't have panicle initiation. I guess it's necessary but not sufficient to get flowering. So, and I should say they repeated this a second year and got a similar pattern, perhaps a slight effect of the gibberellic acid. Close out with this. And so they, back in 1987, says this preceding discussion is based on the assumption that morphological stages of floral differentiation are adequate to distinguish the floral versus the vegetative state of an apex. But it looks like maybe the GA3 treatment, it gives you a change in the vegetative apex that makes it look like a floral apex. But underneath, we haven't really changed the molecular biology. So I guess looking ahead, I have some phenology questions, and it goes, that need to be worked on. It's preanthesis development controlled by a single clock. I think Alec Goswami's data suggests yes. Is the transition of the apex a reliable indicator of molecular controls? The Morgan and Quinby data suggest no. And how can we really improve our models? I think we need to move to the level of dissecting the molecular clock. Move to the level of dissecting the molecular clock, doing quantitative monitoring of signals over time, and get away maybe from the more morphological approach. Thank you. Basic approach.
Sequentially.
Yeah.
It kind of implies there are multiple clocks.
Yeah.
And you get additive error.
Yeah, that's another part of it. Yeah.
What's the single clock idea?
Yeah, well, in fact, yeah, I'm something else or parallel to this. I'd like to see if we can get better calibrations of our models just by using the single, essentially. Dividing up the phases by proportions and just saying, let's assume that there's sort of a proportional split and we calibrate all of it together rather than calibrate this phase, or this phase. And in truth, we'll have a lot of data sets. We don't actually have the intermediate stages to calibrate on anyway.